We'll call the meeting to order at 8:19 a.m. The clerk will note the roll, and I think we are one person short of a quorum right now. So we'll to Greg, step in. Okay, we do have a quorum. And we're going to get started right away with the Department of Employee Relations is first, followed by the Amateur Sports Commission, and then we do have one bill by Representative Rukavina that will move to the register, hopefully, and then we'll be done for the day. And so what we're going to do is do the overview of employee relations. We have Lorna Smith here from the department. We have Commissioner Ludeman here from the department. And if you want to come on down, are you guys ready? Okay. Do you need to use this technology that we have, or
I
you
think
do?
We have it set up.
Okay.
And there's been a little change.
I'm Wendy Dwyer from the Department of Employee Relations, and with me to present the workforce report is Bruce Yurick, also from the Department of Employee Relations.
Wonderful. Whoever wants to do it.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's great.
The Department of Employee Relations is a human resource management agency of Minnesota's executive branch of state government. As part of our mission, we gather employment data and statistics and report them to the legislature, media, and interested public. We have been asked to do a short presentation today that gives a general description of executive branch employment. First, I want to explain by what we mean by executive branch. For our purposes, this includes all cabinet-level agencies and executive branch boards and commissions. Although MNSCU is statutorily part of the executive branch, we do not always count them when reporting. We do this because their hiring patterns are so different from the rest of the executive branch. For example, they will hire one teacher for one class in one semester, while another teacher may teach four classes in two semesters. That hiring pattern obscures the activity within the rest of the executive branch. This point will become clearer as we proceed through our presentation. When we do include MNSCU in our numbers, we will specify that point.
Ms. Dwyer, is this initial part, this is what I had asked for in terms of employment, and so you'll be doing kind of a mini presentation first.
And there's also a handout that I believe that's a little bit more in depth. That's about 20 pages that you have.
They're called State Workforce Report?
Yes.
Okay, members, it looks like this. It's got kind of a purple cover. We're doing that part first before we go over the budget documents. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes, Mr. Chair. This is significant because, as you can see on the chart, they are about 36% of state government. The remaining part of executive branch, the portion we are about to describe, is still about 57% of all state government employment. The state is the largest single employer within Minnesota. Including MNSCU, there are approximately 49,000 state employees. Without MNSCU, there are about 30,300 executive branch employees. Of these, 89% are represented by a labor union. The average state employee is 46 years old, and approximately 18% of the state's current workforce will be eligible for retirement in 2010. We are often asked if the number of state employees is going up or down. And while this seems like an easy question to answer, it is not. Because state employment is large, and there is a lot of churn. Every day, employees are hired, fired, retired, or just quit. All this churn makes it difficult to answer the seemingly simple question. To help get at the answer, we use two primary methods for counting employees. The first method, called FTE, or full-time equivalent, is really a fiscal answer to the question. This method is calculated by taking the total number of hours paid in a given period and dividing by the number of hours of full-time employees would have worked during that time period. This is a useful method in that it answers the question by describing the change in the numbers of hours paid. This is also an important nuance because 50 hours in a week could have been worked by two part-time employees or by one full-time employee with overtime. A simple headcount would have obscured that answer by either leading one to believe that these are two part-time employees are really two full-time employees, or that one full-time employee is working only 40 hours per week. The second method to measure the size of state employment is by appointment count. This is the number of occupied positions or jobs in each state agency. An individual who holds more than one job will be counted as more than one appointment. That being said, the number of FTE in executive branch is down over 6% from fiscal year 01 to fiscal year 04. Over that same time period, appointment count is down by about 5%. FTE, if you notice, the time periods compared are actually different. FTE can only be counted through a completed time period. Consequently, we are looking at fiscal year 01 through fiscal year 04. Appointment count is measured on any given day. Because we use January, we were able to include January of 2005.
Ms. Moyer, does this include Minsky or exclude Minsky?
It excludes Minsky.
Okay, thank you.
Now we have to describe the size of state government. We're going to describe its composition. To give this information a little bit more meaning, we compare the executive branch numbers to either Minnesota's population or its labor force. Executive branch workers are about as evenly divided between the seven-county metro area and greater Minnesota as the general population. According to the last census numbers, 50% of the state's population lives in the seven-county metro area. Including Minsky, almost 50% of executive branch employees work in the metro area. 47% of Minnesota's entire labor force is female, compared to 48% for the executive branch.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Solberg.
What's that number if you take Minsky out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Solberg, I do not.
You could introduce yourself, sir.
Sure. Bruce here, Department of Employee Relations. Are you referring to the count of employees, the distribution across the state?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative, the distribution of state employees of executive branch only excluding Minsky is approximately 40% and 60%. 40% are outstate, 60% are within the metro area.
Thank you. I noticed that when you get to where Minsky College is, the number dramatically goes up for these counties.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, 8% of Minnesota's entire labor force are minorities, with 7% for the executive branch. 14% of Minnesota's entire labor force reports having a disability. However, only 6% of the executive branch workforce reports having a disability. Disability is a tough category for us to accurately measure. We only count an employee as having a disability if they report that they have one. Often, employees are hesitant to report this type of information to employers. We are comparing our numbers to that reported by the census, which is not like reporting to an employer. We believe that this phenomenon impacts the ability to accurately report.
One quick question I had on the state map part. Is this where the state employees live or where they work? Because I know they sometimes will commute from place to place.
Where they work, Mr. Chair.
Where they work.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Now we'll provide you with a look at the wage and benefit costs of the executive branch. $1.9 billion was spent on the executive branch payroll in calendar year 04. This includes wages, FICA, and benefits. Of this, $242 million for health, dental, and life premiums was paid by the executive branch in calendar year 04. The total compensation increased by $106.6 million from calendar year 01 to calendar year 04. This is despite the number of employees going down. Of that increase, the largest portion was health insurance, which cost the state $366 million in calendar year 04 alone. Now, of this $366 million, the executive branch agency has paid about 62%. The dental program cost the state $18 million in calendar year 04, with executive branch agencies paying $11 million. The third program, Basic Life and Disability, cost $7.5 million in calendar year 04, with agencies paying $4.6 million. Next, we will cover sick and vacation leave. A full-time state employee earns 4 hours of sick leave per pay period and between 4 and 9 hours of vacation leave per pay period. The total number of sick hours used is decreasing. However, the per-employee cost is rising. A different pattern follows vacation leave. The total number of hours used has declined since 03, but had increased from 01 to 03. In addition, the per-employee cost is also increasing. This is because vacation leave is based on years of service, and employees are staying in state government longer. As I said before, because state employment is large, there is a lot of churn. Despite the downward trend in employment, some hiring continues. Agencies still need to replace certain skills when an employee leaves or add new employees when a new program comes online. Overall, hiring since fiscal year 01 is down 28%. In fiscal year 01, there were 43 layoffs compared to 356 layoffs in fiscal year 04, resulting in an increase of about 720%. Retirements have held about even.
Representative Silver,
does that figure include Minsky?
No, it does not, Mr. Chair. Representative Silver. That concludes our overview of executive branch employment. We have tried to give you a taste of the size and makeup of state employment. And as I said earlier, we have a booklet that we have provided that does give some additional information for you to review.
Okay, are there questions from members on this part of the presentation? Representative Goldberg.
In the layoffs, do we have a breakdown of the type of layoffs, that categories of where they've been laid off? Have you been executive assistant commissioners, or have they been my forester out and is trying to get the trees up for sale?
I know Representative Silberg, page 29 just has a listing by department, but he's looking for more specific of kind of the position types, I think.
I like the executive summaries better.
Yep.
Mr. Chair, Representative Silberg, we do not have that information with us, but I do believe we can get that information for you.
Thank you.
If you'd like.
Are there some further questions from members on the, I have one myself.
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
maybe that information can be given the best by the type of bargaining unit that the a representative, if they're an ASPE or a MAPE or unclassified.
Mr. Chair, Representative Silver, I think there's, is it reflected in here? I know there was a page. Yeah. Oh, okay. I'm sorry, it was my mistake. I thought that there was some layoff information by bargaining units in this document, but there is not. So we'll get that information for you.
Thank you.
Okay. On page 21 of your handout, I don't know if there's someone who can help that's at the table or if this is someone from the audience potentially, but we've got a lot of people coming forward saying that we should be putting people into the state employee group insurance program, the CGIP program. Veterans coming back, small business people, I don't know whoever. Yesterday there was a press conference, and I don't know who it was. Someone else is supposed to be added in. What consequences are there for just kind of putting people in the state employee group insurance program? My understanding is there might be some legal issues, or you know, we had this discussion in government operations. I don't see Representative Kahn here, but about how we were supposed to get the Humanities Commission out of CGIP because they are no longer state employees and there's supposed to be a integrity of the fund and all of this. So as people are keep having press conferences and saying, let's just put everybody in the state employee, what are the consequences of doing that? Because I honestly don't know.
Mr. Chair, if I can, I'd like to have Liz Holding from, or excuse me, Commissioner Ludeman come and speak to that point.
Commissioner Ludeman, welcome.
Thank you.
Give us an idea of why this may be a good, bad, or otherwise idea, sure, well, legal or not legal or whatever.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Cal Ludeman, the Commissioner of Employee Relations. Well, there is a plethora of problems with that. I mean, first thing it would do is make us an insurance company and then have to live by ERISA rules. We are a self-insured fund with a certain specific pool of state employees, or at least a connection with them. All problems can always be solved, but this would be a very crucial problem that
Mr. Chair
could change the makeup of CGIP loan.
Okay, Representative Silberg.
Mr. Chair, why would that be the case if you took in, let's say, school, other public employees, not private business, but other public employees? Why would that be a...
Mr. Chairman, I think I am going to rely on Liz Holding to help me here, Mr. Silberg.
Ms. Holding, if you can come down and...
And Mr. Chair, it may be illegal, but not necessarily, I mean, by current law, but you could change current law to allow that. I want to know why we would change federal law.
Is ERISA federal or state?
ERISA is federal, but why would that put us into ERISA?
Hey, Ms. Holden, can you give us an idea of why this puts us into ERISA status?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Liz Holding. I'm the Employee Insurance Division Director. We could include other governmental employees in our plan without losing our governmental status. The issue is non-governmental employees.
Ms. Holding, how does the National Guard fit in? Are they considered public employees, non-public employees? You know, they float back and forth between active duty. They come back from Iraq. They go back into being a...
We are interpreting their possibility of being in the plan as coming under the control of the state, and that would then make them a governmental employee that could be included in our plan.
What are the consequences of the state being involved in the ERISA process if we get into small business owners and all that kind of thing?
Mr. Chair, that would be... that would have quite a bit of consequence for the state. There's reporting requirements and licensing requirements and all kinds of other requirements that we are not responsible for doing at this particular time, and it would add to the administrative burden quite phenomenally.
Yeah, maybe you could give us a little briefing or a little handout at some point, and what are the consequences of adding non-state employees or non-governmental employees to the CGIP program. Did you have some other thoughts on this matter?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, yes, I do. You know, the biggest problem is the entry and exit of any group of employees within a certain defined pool. So the problem is if local units of government, any other public entity were to come into the current state employee pool, are they then obliged to stay? But if they can pick and choose any year of exit or entry, this is what would be the biggest a problem with the maintaining the claim experience of a certain pool of employees. This would be true of any group insurance plan. In other words, if everyone is mandated to be a member of a certain pool and stay, that certainly would be manageable. The other part, the risk selection, the adverse selection problem would be simply not be able to be calculated for the actuarial rate setting of the premiums. We wouldn't know what the potential claim liability of the pool would be. That's the biggest single problem.
All right. Do we have any other questions or comments from members on this part of the presentation? This is.
We have more, Mr. Chairman.
We will have Doer's presentation on your budget and your particulars of your office. But if you want to talk about workforce, the size of the state workforce, those types of things, then that's for right now. Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioner Ludeman. I was reading in a publication last week that the state of Indiana had calculated that state employees were spending a little over 100,000 hours per year on union activities. As you probably know, the state of Indiana recently saw their governor rescind collective bargaining authority by executive order. But my question to you, Mr. Commissioner, is, does the state of Minnesota track, do we have any idea of how many hours are lost each year to union activities?
Commissioner Ludeman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative DeLaForest, other than the ability to calculate them, what we do know is that there are fairly tight regulations for at least any state-paid time for union activities doesn't happen. Whether union officials are on leave for their activity or not, that calculation, I don't know if we're able to calculate or have information. Deputy Commissioner Larson is here. He may be able to answer that question a little bit more specifically.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, if they're on leave, they're not being paid, right?
That's correct. Of computers on state time.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, for example, if you look at the AFSCME contract, it's rather open-ended, for example. It says, for example, processing grievances, that time off, reasonable time off will be granted. what is that? I mean, that's during the workday, and it comes at no loss of pay to the employee. So the taxpayers are footing the bill for that, for example. Furthermore, although, Mr. Larson, it may be outside the scope of Doer a little bit, when you look at the MSCF contract, for example, you get a full year of release time for the president of MSCF, which, of course, means that that person is full-time as the union president on the state payroll. So definitely there is a bill to be paid by the taxpayers, and I think it would be helpful if we had a handle on exactly what that is.
Do you have any additions? Have you had to introduce yourself and your position?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Larson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Employee Relations. I also oversee collective bargaining for the non-faculty bargaining units within the executive branch. Representative De La Forest, to the extent that we have every hour tracked, no, we don't. We do for paid leave. We have for processing grievances within the workplace. The employee, the grievant, is on state paid time, and then the collective bargaining agreements have a limitation as to how many union representatives are there on paid time. Typically, the grievance procedure is three steps, and we allow the employee and the union steward to be there on paid time. Sometimes they have other representatives there, but then they are not on paid time. We also have if the grievance is not resolved at the agency level and they proceed to arbitration, the union is responsible for reimbursing their representatives as well as all of the expenses and everything as far as witnesses are concerned. So the concept, at least from resolving the workplace dispute, is that we'll try to get it resolved at the first three steps at the agency level, but if it's not resolved and they want to take us to arbitration, then it's on their nickel, so to speak. With regard to other forms of paid union leave, it's very limited, but for example, we have union negotiations. We're in the process now of starting contract negotiations, and the time spent by the union at the bargaining table is not on the employer's time, the responsibility of the unions. So I'm not familiar with the faculty agreement, but to the extent I believe that most of the union activity outside of processing the grievances is unpaid or it's the responsibility of the union.
Okay. Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chairman, just to represent De La Forest, grievance is a management problem. If there's a problem with, it's not a union problem, it's a management interpretation of the contract. So that can be put back on the management side equally as well.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, I at least have the understanding that the collective bargaining agreement and the process is supposed to be a joint process. I've never spoken with any union leadership who has ever at least told me otherwise, that generally, philosophically, it's supposed to be a joint process and a cooperative one. So I don't know if I would put grievances or anything else either on management or on the unions. I think... It's a contract.
Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Forest, you had just put it on the union before, and I wanted to make sure that it is indeed a joint problem, or it's a management interpretation of the contract, and the Assistant Commissioner is absolutely right. You have some processes go through, and you try to solve those conflicts, and you have conflicts in any kind of a workplace situation, particularly with that number of employees you have. You try to solve those as equitable and as quickly as you possibly can and as cheaply as you possibly can, instead of trying to go to all arbitration, which is expensive for both sides of the aisle.
Well, Representative Solberg, I think you missed the point, though. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize. That when we have workers, workers are hired by the state to do a particular job, and the job isn't to be engaged in union activities. And I'm not suggesting that time isn't well spent or that I think it's wrong. But it's undeniable that if a state employee, this stuff doesn't normally happen on nights and weekends. If that state employee is engaged in union activity, then they're not doing their primary job to serve the citizens of the state. And I was merely asking the question, do we know to what extent these things are happening? I'm not suggesting it's a good thing or a bad thing. I was curious because apparently some other jurisdictions at least are tracking this and they're trying to get their arms around it. And I think Representative Solberg, it's undeniable that Minnesota, under Chapter 179A, we certainly have a very, very extensive collective bargaining system, and the public employee unions compared to other states especially certainly have a lot of bargaining power in the state. So I just think it's an important issue, and I was just merely wondering if we had any mechanism by which we track some of that usage.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sol.
And just a little bit of point of history, the collective bargaining appellate law was championed by Ashcroft, who is a Republican.
Yeah, I know that.
Interesting.
Are we finished on this topic?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Larson, if you just want to hang around for 1 second, I just have a couple more questions. One is, at Minsky Central, the discussion has been had that they have a lot of employees who do just collective bargaining. That's a lot. I've got the Minsky roster of all their employees, and there's a lot of people who just do labor negotiations. Is there a reason why they are separate from Doer in their negotiations? Is it has that just been the way it is, and we've never questioned that, or is there any economy of scale issues? My guess is you don't want to get into the business of negotiating with CCFA, IFO, and UTC, but what's been the history there? Is there a reason Minsky is a separate entity for bargaining and Doer has been out of the picture there?
Mr. Chairman, I'll do the best to answer that. I do have a bit of a historical perspective on that. And that years ago, depending on how far back you want to go, we used to have over 100 collective bargaining agreements. And in the, you know, Pelleraw first arrived on the scene in the early 70s, and it was in the early 1980s, that they created these huge, large occupational units, and the NSCU at that time was called the State University System, was responsible for since they had the faculty there, but the Department of Employee Relations initially was responsible for the negotiations of the faculty agreements, and it obviously predates me, but from my predecessors and the conversations that I've had with them, the decision was made that Minsky would be responsible, again, this was at that time the state university system, would be responsible for the negotiations of the faculty agreements because of the uniqueness, so to speak, of the faculty agreements. The Department of Employee Relations delegated that authority to the state university system with the understanding that before any money was put on the table, that we would be apprised of that, and then we actually had final say in the settlement of the agreements. And as time has gone by, and now through greater autonomy with Minsky, the Department of Employee Relations, and I believe this is actually in legislation, we do not have that oversight like we used to have.
Representative Fulberg.
Mr. Chairman, I think on the time frame of that was, I want to say, 1998, when the Minsky came and did not want to have the oversight. I believe that's about the right time frame. I and others oppose that because I do think that the Department of Employee Relations had at least some kind of an oversight of their collective bargaining. You also provided some services to them as well that they did, I think, reimburse the state for. But it was the wrong way to go. But I guess it's worked out okay. I would still like to have had the Department of Employee Relations have some kind of an oversight of that negotiations. But we lost that in, I want to say, 96 or 98 in that area someplace.
Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had two quick questions, maybe for Mr. Larson. Just curious, in looking at the current collective bargaining agreements, we still have the concepts of, for example, sick leave. And I'm wondering if there has been any discussion with the unions about the possibility of moving to a paid time off system. As you know, for example, sick leave just breeds all sorts of issues on both sides of the table. You get sort of getting these Keystone Cop scenarios about was John employee really sick, or, you know, was overzealous management trying to get after somebody. You can get in all sorts of wacky scenarios. And same with bereavement leave, for example. We're put in this process of trying to decide who's important enough when they die to allow time off. And I was just curious if there's been any thought to sort of going to a paid time off system, so it doesn't matter what the reason is. If it fits within the mission and the workload allows it, the employee can go take time off to do whatever they wish.
Mr. Chairman and Representative De La Flores, but if I may, Mr. Chairman, answer the other question about the Minsku autonomy. We still have the authority in the with the Minsku faculty and Minsku, I should say, on insurance. We have not delegated that authority, just to correct on that. But with respect to the Representative De La Flores' question on sick leave versus paid time off, we've spent many hours and days and years discussing the concept of a what we call paid time off. The sick leave program that we've inherited in the Department of Employee Relations predates collective bargaining and goes back to the civil services days. In fact, the 4 hours of sick leave has been around for probably 50, 60 years. And while there has been discussion in moving to that, it's tied to our severance pay. The employees, as you heard, earn 4 hours of sick leave every pay period. Well, it's 104 hours a year, and they can use sick leave under certain circumstances for themselves. We have expanded the use of sick leave for members of the family and other situations. We've expanded the use of sick leave for bereavement leave under certain situations. The severance pay that we pay is 40% of the first 900 hours and then 12.5% of the hours after that. So you may have an employee that has worked for the state for 20 years and through their good health and luck has 2,000 hours of sick leave because you can earn 104 hours a year. That's a fairly substantial severance payout for him. On the other hand, you might have an employee that's worked for the state for 20 years and only has 8 hours on the books. And one of the stumbling blocks that we have when we start looking at paid time off is making the break. How are you going to make the break? And, of course, when we start talking about it at the bargaining table, it's a hold harmless situation, and it collapses because if we were to say that, well, we'll leave the current system in place for those who want it, and then we'll move to paid time off where they get maybe 8 or 10 days of paid time off a year, it's just something we simply cannot afford. And to tell someone that's 53, 54 years old that may have 3,000 hours of sick leave that they're no longer going to get severance pay because we're going to go to a paid time off, and it's a real problem. Some government jurisdictions have done this, so someday maybe we can continue to do that, but Representative De La Flores, yes, I'm very familiar with that concept.
I guess I always thought they called it vacation pay or paid time. Isn't that vacation? Or am I missing something? They have to call it something else.
Mr. Chairman, what ends up happening is they basically combine both. You get so many days a year you get that you can use, and you can use them whether or not it's for vacation or sick leave. And that's why we call it paid time off. Sometimes it's called personal time off.
Okay.
But you just get a lot of employers. For example, a lot of private sector, you know, the first year you don't get anything.
Right.
And then the next year you get 10 days. And then after 5 years you might get 15 days. And after 25 years you get 30 days. And how you use those days, to the extent that you can't disrupt the workplace as far as, you know, there's some predictability in when you show up for work. And then employers will liquidate that in cash to you at the end of the year if you don't use those, and we don't have that concept in place.
Okay. Representative De La Flores, did you have a follow-up, and then Representative Kahn?
I didn't have a follow-up, so Representative Kahn has a follow-up. I've got a different question.
Yes, exactly this point. I'd actually like to know what the cost would be. I don't understand how it's an additional cost. You take the current employees and hold them harmless.
Grandfather them
to the existing one. That's something that you've been totally budgeted for. Then you look at new employees and say, and just put them on that, and what the cost is for that. I would assume that the cost isn't much more, and I don't understand why it's an additional cost to work it out in that manner. I'd just like to see the numbers that say that.
Mr. Larson, any kind of analysis on grandfathering the current people in, and then what it might cost, if anything?
I see how it could cost anything.
You might reduce, you know, they might like the flexibility of the new plan, and then maybe not as much on severance later or something.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I'm sure I can get that information to you, but I can give you a summary of where I see the cost is. Let's say, for example, under the current system right now, you earn 4 hours of sick leave every pay period. There's 26 pay periods in the year, so that's 104 hours of sick leave a year. And you also earn 4 hours of vacation a year, so that's 208 hours of paid time off that you're eligible for the first year when you start working. After 5 years with the state, that 4 hours then moves to, I believe it's 5 hours, and then at a certain time you earn 7 hours of vacation, and ultimately after a period of time you can earn 8.5 hours of vacation with the state. But the sick leave is not, it's what you would call a perpetual insurance plan. If you're not sick, you don't get it. So if you have your health in the first year and you're working, you earn 104 hours of sick leave, but if you weren't sick, we don't pay that out. And so if we were to move to a concept where we're going to pay it out and that they could use it without being sick, the person then would use those 104 hours. And so when we start talking with the unions, we say, well, you can't use 104, let's start out at half of that. We hit the wall in the bargaining process.
Well, I guess I'd still like to see there's certain people who might think that I'd like to continue this to be just like traditional sick leave, because I'm worried that I may need this insurance policy. Or I would like severance pay, even though it's less than I would get. So you don't even know how many people would decide to move. Even if it was paid time off, we'd still treat it just like traditional sick leave. I don't see any reason not to continue, not to just treat it as sick leave, but just to loosen the ability of people to use it for anything. It just seems to me that it's a workforce-friendly thing, because people would, you know, be able to plan a little bit, and certainly is a family-friendly device. I don't know how. Do you allow people to take sick leave for caring for sick children? Is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, yes, we do.
Yeah.
Okay, Representative DeLaForest, then we're going to kind of move on with any last questions. We actually have to get your budget presentation, too.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up, Commissioner Ludeman or Mr. Larson. I'm just curious. I saw, wasn't too long ago, I think the OLA did a study about how Minnesota state employees compensation-wise fare vis-a-vis their private sector counterparts here in the state. I'm just curious, do we have any information about how Minnesota state employees fare with respect to their counterparts in neighboring states like Wisconsin or North or South Dakota in terms of compensation and benefits?
Mr. Larson?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative De La Forest, yes, we do. We have extensive information. We have a compensation unit that is constantly monitoring the pay and benefits for other public sector jurisdictions, and that includes the contiguous states. Also, we look at states on where we have the same population set. We also look at government sector jurisdictions within the state of Minnesota, and we also do comparisons of how some of our occupational units stand with private sector jurisdictions.
Representative Solberg.
One quick question. A few years ago, we had a difficult time attracting and keeping high-tech people. And we actually made a law that allowed the Department of Employee Relations to pay some things over and above their contract for those type of positions. Can you give me some indication of how that's working, or do we still have a problem, or did that solve the problem?
And
your turnover?
Mr. Larson?
That type of a person, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, yes, I can give you that information. In general, this is, I think, a concept that has, we had a real market issue in the early 90s when the information technology series and occupations surfaced in the workplace. And just like all other employers, we were scrambling. And so as a result of that, the salaries for the information technology classes increased significantly greater and at a faster pace than the other classes. we have plateaued out now, in my opinion, in that occupation. And this is a comparison in the whole entire occupation. And the last time we looked at that, we have good, solid information that indicates that the compensation that we provide for our information technology series is within the market rate of what's currently out there. We're not above it, and we're not below it, but we're right. We're in a good spot.
Very good thing.
Okay, I don't know if this is a question for you guys or for the Department of Administration, but we had a lot of questions in the last biennium about private use of, and we didn't even know how many cell phones, government-issued cell phones, private use of state vehicles and all that. Is that more of a Department of Administration issue?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, they did the inventory tonight. I think that's the place
okay,
to go.
Okay, we'll have them come back another time for that. Okay, why don't we get your budget presentation up and get started, because we have amateur sports to do yet, and we have a small bill that we have to do as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ludeman, welcome.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having us. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to probably go with all due speed here now to give a brief overview, and we'd like to get to some level of detail and specificity about what's happening at the Department of Employee Relations. The Department of Employee Relations is the human... Are you ready? The Department of Employee Relations is the human resource management agency for state government. In other words, we provide services to other state agencies so that they are able to accomplish their mission in a cost-effective and efficient manner. Without doer services, in other words, the state agency would indeed have to duplicate many of our functions, increasing the overall cost of state operations. Doer has three core functions. We're the state benefit administrators, the Labor Relations Office, and the coordinators of all executive branch human resource management. As the state benefit administrators, we provide employee insurance benefits. We also operate a workers' compensation program to help limit the liability to state government. That is for state employees. And we have created an innovative state health insurance program called Advantage, which has just received the 2004 Innovations Award from the Council of State Governments. In addition, our two lead benefit administrators were the runner-ups of the Benefit Professionals of the Year Award by the Employee Benefit News. That's both public and private sector. Liz Holding, who you just heard from a little earlier, was one of the recipients of that award. As the state's labor relations professionals, we negotiate and administrate 8 labor agreements and develop and administer 2 compensation plans. We set statewide policy for management's relationship with both state employees and unions. We provide training to both managers and supervisors to ensure consistent contract application across all state agencies, and we conduct investigations when complaints are filed by employees. And finally, we coordinate and manage the state human resource system. We set personnel policy, define procedures, and provide a personnel information infrastructure for over 120 state agencies, boards, and commissions. We administer the state selection and classification systems to ensure that state employment is conducted with fairness, equity, and transparency. We provide a centralized online database known as ResumeX, through which the public applies for state employment. We process an average of 5,000 resumes per month. During the last session, the state's new hiring process was codified. This reform moved the state from a paper-intensive process that took more than an average of 120 days to fill a job. Our new electronic process has brought that to 40 days to fill a position, which exceeds the industry average of 45 days. You should know that our hiring process is now one of the leaders for both the public and the private sectors in the use of technology. This reform has been highlighted in several professional journals, which I'd be more than glad to give to anybody. In addition, the Government Performance Project released its annual grading of the states at the end of January and gave the state a B-plus in people management. Doer strategic workforce planning and hiring were identified as being particularly strong in that report. We are proud of how we administered our core services while providing technological efficiencies in order to meet our budget challenges. Since fiscal 2002, we have been able to achieve success despite having more than a 30% budget reduction and an over 30% reduction in staff. We have achieved this by developing technological innovations and administrative reorganizations, which resulted in increased productivity and new efficiencies. There has been some pain, but we've been able to successfully manage. We can expect to continue to use technology to prove improve productivity. We're in the final stages of developing an online system that will allow local units of government to submit their pay equity report online. We anticipate this will not only assist DOER staff, but will make filing easier for the 1,500 local units of government. We began implementing State Employee Express, we call it C, an electronic tool that allows state employees to access specific tailored information about their insurance benefits and HR policies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mr. Chairman, can I ask a quick question?
Representative Kahn, at this point?
Yes. When will the online pay equity reporting be done?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, it's being tested right now. It should be online, or I think it's passing all tests so far. We may be able to exhibit it, I would think, within 2 months, if you're interested. Thank you. We have developed an online system that brings newly hired employees into state service faster and more efficiently. This new system is called onboarding, which is also very close to being online. The theme that follows all these innovations is productivity. We have worked hard to ensure that all these innovations reduce the workload of not only DOER staff, but also for other agencies and local units of government. We've been more than technology, though we've improved and in some instances changed the way we delivered services. We've reorganized the agency to help direct our human resource assets. I'd like to tell you about one of the more specific administrative efficiencies that you may have heard about and we think has been an important improvement. This opportunity arose in our Employee Assistance Program, or EAP. This is the program that provides confidential and accessible counseling services to state employees and their dependents in all three branches of state government. It arose through the unique and rare situation of having two key employees leaving while we were struggling with how to sustain a viable network of services to our employees in greater Minnesota. To solve the networking problem, we did outsource the clinical portion of EAP. This has worked very well and has resulted in a much better network for employees in greater Minnesota. Our in-house EAP staff still provide services to agencies, but their focus has been refined to the most severely counterproductive workplace behaviors. We continue to look for other areas. I'd like to now go through a quick budget overview and change items that appear in the budget. For this biennium, the governor is recommending a general fund appropriation of $11.2 million. This includes a reduction of $1.153 million, or 9.3% of DOER's 05 general fund-based budget. We also have a general fund open appropriation of $1.027 million, which I'll talk about in a moment. The agency also has significant non-general fund monies. These are statutory appropriations that are dedicated for specific purposes. We'll provide the additional detail on these funding sources when we go over the insurance division's budget. The governor's recommendations include four budget change items. You can see them listed on the screen. We have met our budget challenges through increased productivity, resulting in both technical and administrative changes. We have done this through several measures. First, we have eliminated vacancies. These are positions which the employee voluntarily left for another job or retirement. Not all vacancies go unfilled. When they do occur, we analyze the functions and duties before making the decision to fill or eliminate. We believe we can manage without these positions. One was the individual who provided the administrative support to both pay equity and affirmative action. As I've explained earlier, the pay equity online reporting system will offset the need of this position. We have also eliminated a position that assisted with staffing, classification, and job evaluation programs. Another method has been to eliminate positions due to retirements. We are adapting our work based on one future retirement in DOER leadership. The loss of this leadership position may require some reorganization and possibly some legislation as early as next year. We have also reduced a position in our public employee insurance program after retirement. We have reallocated these duties to existing staff. This works because we were able to purchase additional accounting services from our own general fund unit. This provides a win-win for both units. In addition to the PEEP, we call it PEEP efficiency, CGIP will begin paying their share of new technology we've implemented over the last year. One of those is the State Employee Express, or C, that we talked about. This is the primary method for employees to view their insurance information, which means we don't mail out 65-page flyers to 48,000 state employees. Next, we are recommending the elimination of the Right to Know program. The associated funding was used to pay for a contract that helped agencies deal with certain workplace hazards and related training. In its place, we're already using the Poison Control Center, operated out of the Hennepin County Medical Center and funded by the State Department of Health. Our staff met with the Poison Control staff and found our hazardous information needs matched the type of service they are providing to the public. We have already moved to this system, and it is working well. Unfortunately, all of this does not equal our budget reduction. We have already given notices to two employees for layoffs. These employees provide administrative services internal to DOER and workforce planning services to state agencies. However, we will still need to eliminate at least two more positions. These reductions will come either through layoffs or attrition. I'm holding off on making these decisions in hope of at least one additional retirement. I can tell you that these positions will come from the Human Resource Management Division.
Commissioner, with the 03 reductions that your agency took a pretty hefty bite, how many layoffs have you instituted or position vacancies if you had retirements over the last couple of years?
Well, the fiscal 03 year, I think, resulted in 28 layoffs at the Department of Employee Relations, if I recall the number.
Looks like we need to be moving you around from cabinet post to cabinet post.
Well, I was with the... That was a dramatic number, a percentage, certainly the highest percentage number of state employees of any state agency.
28, and how many do you have total? You don't have that.
Well, our FTEs are now down to about 149, something like that. We're not a very big agency, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I'm interested in the right to know issue, and I'm interested
yes.
in how the right to know function coincides with the poison control function. Let me say specifically in the case where there are some agencies that probably have large number of, potentially hazardous chemicals like DNR and so forth. How is that the same kind of information?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Conn, a lot of the larger agencies, DNR, DOT, the ones that have access, have their own workplace, work-to-know programs. For the most part, the contract, while it was statewide, was for most of the benefit of the smaller boards and agencies and small agencies and staffing agencies that have a little less common exposure to a right to know.
So what were they doing before that? What happened before that?
Before the contract?
Yes.
Well, I don't think they were, Mr. Larson, I don't think they were actually doing much before the administration of the contract, because I don't think the Poison Control Center had the information available either. I don't know when it existed. The evolution has been, Mr. Chairman, Representative Conn, the evolution has been mostly about education and information, and the Poison Control Center is considerably more sophisticated in its information delivery system and helping now state agencies themselves.
Right, but the right to know function is the idea that people have the right to know what kind of hazardous materials are around them, and I'm not sure that the Poison Control Center deals with that. I just don't know how it deals.
No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Conn, no, the agencies themselves still have the responsibility to implement the right to know of the employees to know of a hazardous workplace situation. They've always had that. It's the information providing was through the contract.
I guess I don't understand what was eliminated.
What was eliminated?
Yeah. How that got to personnel elimination or cost.
I may need a little help. Mr. Chairman, if you will, we're going to get to the specific...
If you can get back to this issue.
Sure.
I could have Ms. Holding talk to you personally if you wish.
Well, I think...
She's right here. She's right here.
I ought to be interested in this.
Okay. Ms. Holding? Welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, the services that the Poison Control Center is providing to state employees is information regarding the chemicals and exposures that they could be exposed to during a work day and at the workplace. In addition to that, there's training that we are providing as well as state agencies to employees for purposes of fulfilling the obligations of right to know. So it's information regarding chemical extraction as well as workplace safety. And both of those needs are now being met either through our staff and staff at the agencies, as indicated by the commissioner, and the Poison Control Center when it comes to chemicals.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we still have our safety unit in Door, as far as the safety issue. The Poison Control Center was about more the chemical.
I still don't understand what was eliminated when you made this contract.
What did the contractor do?
You just changed the way you were doing it, right? You didn't abolish the right to know program. You just changed the way the delivery system works, correct?
Right. In the past, we had a contract with a vendor to provide training and information regarding chemical exposure. That vendor no longer wanted to work with us.
So it's a change of contract with vendors. So
right. But now it's being done for free because the Poison Control already exists. Poison Control Center already exists.
Originally sounded like they weren't doing it anymore. I think you and I were thinking the same way, but it's different. Yeah. Representative Mallory?
Yeah, we got a better deal. I guess that's the deal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wondered, since we have a lot of construction, there's a lot of injuries in that, but I don't know whether we have a lot of state employees. Do we have our safety program set up employees for all the construction work that's actually done by state employees? Do we have any thing on that, safety regulations and training?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Mulry, we have a safety unit at Dewar in specifically for training, but most of the agencies that we don't have a lot of state workers that do actual. They're in circumstances, but they're not in the construction business. In other words, I don't know if you're referring to the state buildings being built. These aren't state employees. The ones that are in the large departments, DOT, DNR, Department of Administration, have their own safety and safety training units within their own departments.
Okay. Go ahead.
Well, one more question.
Real quick.
Is the Poison Control Center, is that the one? Is that supported by the county then?
Yes, that's the Poison Control Center at Hennepin County Medical Center.
So Hennepin County ought to be charging you a fee then to supply those services.
Hennepin, the Poison Control Center is funded by the Minnesota Department of Health.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We'd like to give you even more specific information. I'm going to have Lorna Smith go as fast as she can.
Good morning, Chair members. My name is Lorna Smith. Dewar's budget is divided into two programs, Human Resource Management and the Employee Insurance Division. The first program, Human Resource Management, provides a number of centralized personnel services for the executive branch, and it provides the administrative services internal to Dewar. This program has four activities and 61.5 FTE, or 43% of the agency. The bulk of this program's funding is from the general fund. For this program, the governor recommends a biannual general fund appropriation of $11.2 million. The program carries the bulk of the agency's reductions for a total of $1,027,000. As we go through the activities, we'll explain where those reductions occur. In addition to the general fund appropriation, this program also has special revenue funds of $2,179,000. The bulk of these revenues are payments received for services provided to the non-general fund portions of DOOR. The first activity, administration, provides the agency's operational infrastructure. This includes all the technical support for the several statewide systems we run, including ResumeX and C, as well as Semaphore, the state's payroll and HR system, and GenCom, the state compensation workers system. They also manage and support the department's internal technology requirements, such as desktop computers, related software, hardware, and telephones. This activity is responsible for other support functions, the mailroom accounting, the receptionist, and the commissioner's office. They run two programs, the Combined Charities Program and the Vacation Donation Program. The Combined Charities Program enables state employees to make payroll deductions to donate to the charities of their choice, and the Vacation Donation Program allows state employees to donate their earned vacation time to coworkers who are in need of additional leave due to a medical condition. The administrative activity is recommended receive a biennial general fund appropriation of $5.6 million. This represents a $596,000 reduction for the biennium. We achieve this reduction through a layoff and the elimination of two positions through attrition. Also, part of this reduction will be offset by the additional funding from the insurance division. EID will purchase that increased support that was required for the elimination of the PEAT position, and they'll begin paying some of their share of operating some of those new technologies the Commissioner described. The special revenue appropriation of $1.8 million has two purposes. The bulk of that are monies paid from the other units of DOOR to purchase and maintain their desktop computers and those related services. And the remaining $48,000 includes an $8,000 in registration fees that we pass on to the Combined Charities Board to operate the campaign. And the remaining monies are collected from staff fundraisers in all agencies, and we pass those on directly to the participating charities. The next activity is labor relations and compensation. The crux of their duties is to negotiate and administer the 8 labor agreements covering 13 bargaining units, and they develop and administer 2 compensation plans affecting over 36,000 executive branch employees. To this end, the unit provides training for managers and supervisors, and they represent the state in grievances, appeals, arbitration. They manage 2 programs with dealing with local units of government. The first, local government pay equity, which ensures that political subdivisions eliminate all sex-based wage inequities through a report that is filed once every 5 years. And the other program reviews the local compensation waiver requests to pay employees in excess of 95% of the governor's salary. This unit is recommended to receive a biennial general fund appropriation of $1.8 million. The biennial statutory funding of $317,000 are pass-through dollars, the bulk of which are paid by agencies to purchase investigatory services, and about $5,000 is raised through training activities of labor relations staff. The third activity in this program is agency and applicant services. This unit serves human resource staff, as well as managers and supervisors in all 120 executive branch agencies. These are the people that set the HR personnel policies, procedures. They consult with agencies on a wide variety of HR topics, including job analysis, hiring, equal opportunity, affirmative action, and workforce analysis. And this is a unit that accepts those 5,000 applications per month for employment. They accomplish these tasks and more with a biennial appropriation of $2.6 million. Included in this recommendation is a biennial reduction of $431,000. They accomplish this through one layoff, the elimination of a vacancy, and those other undetermined changes that was already explained by the Commissioner. The last activity in this program is the HR Technology and Analytics Unit. This activity is responsible for the utilization enhancement of technology and data for state hiring and employment activities. Now, to be clear, the administrative unit I previously described maintains our technology. These people use and develop that technology. For budgetary purposes, we divide them on a daily basis. They do all work together. The staff in this activity work on the development and use of a variety of information systems, including Semaphore, which is the state's hiring resource management tool, ResumeX, the state's system that processes the 5,000 applications, and they're the people that are currently developing and implementing onboarding. They also maintain and analyze data regarding the state's workforce to help identify staffing and future hiring trends. This function is recommended to receive a general fund appropriation of $1,091,000, and there are no recommended reductions here. The second program is the insurance division. It administers employee insurance benefits for the state of Minnesota's eligible employees, retirees, and their dependents. They also administer a benefit program for local units of government. They have 81 FTE and 4 budget activities. The first 3 of these budget activities operates a program, and the non-operating activity is a pass-through account for the premiums, administrative fees, and claims paid on behalf of the other 3 activities. Under this budget recommendation, EIG will receive that general open fund appropriation of $1,027,000. This appropriation is the premium due to the Workers' Compensation Reinsurance Association. This is legislative required reinsurance that is paid on behalf of the entire state as an employer. These premium dollars pass to the account and purchase this reinsurance for all 3 branches of state government and some quasi-state agencies. EID operates with pretty significant statutory appropriations. We have three separate funds that we use. The State Employee Insurance Fund contains the SIGIP and PEAT monies. The Miscellaneous Agency Fund holds the pre-tax accounts, and the special revenues are the workers' compensation monies. These funds are generated from two basic streams, premiums and user fees, and we'll explain each of these as we go through these activities. The first activity is the Employee Insurance Administration. This is the state employee benefit program known as SIGA. It provides benefits to over 120,000 covered lives for employees, retirees, or dependents from all three branches of state government, as well as certain quasi-agencies such as the Historical Society and the State Fair. The benefits they administer are health, dental, and life insurance, as well as short and long-term disability, long-term care, and pre-tax benefits for health, dental, dependent care costs, and transportation costs. The special revenue funding is $2.9 million, and it's for the pre-tax and long-term care programs. These fees pay for both SIGIP and the vendor's share of the operation of these two programs. The long-term care program is fully paid by the users, with state agencies paying nothing for that benefit. The long-term care revenue is a fee paid by the vendor to cover our costs of administering the program. SIGIP's administrative fees are $16.1 million. These costs are primarily funded through a fee paid by state agencies, paid by former employees on COBRA and retirees over age 65. SIGIP, to be clear on this, operates on fees equaling about 8% of just the health plan's total costs. Of this 8%, SIGIP operates on only 1%, while the health plans use the remaining dollars to provide the networks, they pay the claims, and the other administrative duties. It's important to note that the industry standard is to use 10 to 15% on these administrative functions. The second activity is PEEP, or the Public Employee Insurance Program. This is a statewide health dental insurance pool managed by DOOR and offered to local units of government. The program provides Minnesota's public employers, this includes counties, cities, school districts, and other jurisdictions, the option to purchase affordable, uniform package of benefits for their employees, retirees, and their dependents. Currently, this program is serving 123 public employers and 7,800 covered lives. The program takes in $47 million per biennium in premiums and fees, and all this is paid by the local units of government and their employees. The activity administers the benefit on an operating biennial budget of $530,000. They use another $556,000 to purchase the underwriting, actuarial, financial, and the general administrative support needed to run the program. The remaining $46 million are the biennial costs of the insurance. Due to retirement, this unit has lost one FTE, and that position has now been eliminated. As stated earlier, part of this funding for this eliminated position will go to pay for some additional accounting services, and the rest will go towards holding down the fees charged to local units of government. Workers' compensation is a third activity. It's a self-insured, self-administered risk management services for controlling the state workers' compensation liability. It serves approximately 56,000 state employees in all three branches of government, as well as those state, most quasi-state agencies such as the Historical Society. The program offers four areas of service. We do claims management. We investigate and determine liability and manage the ongoing activities for over 3,000 claims filed annually. They provide legal services for the defense of state agencies and workers' compensation claims. They do disability management, that's the providing of vocational rehabilitation services for state employees in accordance with workers' compensation laws. And this is the safety and industrial hygiene we were speaking about earlier. They are the loss control services for state agencies to help identify and correct workplace hazards that put state employees in risk of work-related injuries and illnesses. It operates from a biennial special revenue fund appropriation of $6.8 million, and all these are funds paid from to the workers' comp from the other state agencies. These fees are paid through two different options. Small agencies participate through what's essentially a fully insured plan, which charges an experience-based premium. This ensures that agencies that have a consistent payment with no large unexpected claims. Larger agencies follow the pay-as-you-go option. That allows those agencies to pay for their direct costs of workers' comp claims. This means that they have no outstanding claims. They only pay the administrative fee, However, if they have a large unexpected claim, they are liable for that. As with SIGIP, the agencies pay their these administrative fees to support the activity. Included here is the recommendation to eliminate the general fund appropriation of $126,000, which brought the contract, you know, which paid for that contract, the commissioner complained, explained on the right to know. Yeah. Finally, our last activity is the non-operating activity. This is really an accounting mechanism. It's a pass-through account. Consequently, there are no employees in this activity. All the premiums paid by state agencies, employees, and the WCRA premium are, that's paid by the general fund are placed into these pass-through accounts and are used to pay for the insurance premiums, claims, and the vendor's administrative fees. These are ongoing activities, and so the dollars carry over from year to year. The general fund appropriation of the $1 million is the WCRA premium payment. The special revenue funds of $39.6 million are the workers' compensation funds. These dollars are used to pay claims which consists of both the medical costs and the payments to injured employees. It also includes an assessment paid to the Department of Labor and Industry for uninsured claims that is paid by all employers and insurers in the state. We expect the State Employee Insurance Fund to pass through nearly $1.2 billion during the upcoming biennium. These are the funds that pay premiums and claims and administrative costs of the plans. Payments are made of this account by state agencies, former employees, employees on COBRA, and retirees. The health care costs are by far the biggest piece of the pie here at $1.1 million for the biennium. The final fund is the miscellaneous agency fund. It contains $36.9 million, and these are employee dollars for their contributions to the pre-tax programs. These are pass-through dollars that cover their pre-tax medical, dental, transit, and daycare expenses. That is the detailed summary of our budget, and I'll pass it off back to
Representative Kahn.
Yes, I would like, going back to page 4 on ours, the labor relations activity, I'd like to know if there's any estimate about of what you spend reviewing local compensation waivers.
We've had a lot of discussion on the compensation of city administrators and all that. Have you had a lot of reviewals?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, don't spend a lot of money on it right now because we don't receive too many waiver requests right now.
Commissioner, do you know how many you've had? Or I know Representative Earhart has a bill coming to GovOps, and maybe you'll be testifying on that. I'm not sure.
I'm going to guess if that's right, Mr. Chairman. Sure. I would think since the beginning from the last approvals early in January of 2003, since then there's probably been 20 waiver requests. Approximately in the last 2 years.
20 in 2 years?
Yes.
Representative Kahn?
Other thing I'm interested in is the CGIP analysis. This question came up when we were in government operations, omitting the Humanities Commission, and I must complain that I did receive wrong information from the person in the department at that time who said that the legislation that was passed eliminated them as if they weren't restored as of the end of last year, and it was as of the end of this year. And the person did say that it was supposed to be as of 2004, and looking at the legislation, and the group passed, the committee passed the bill, which eliminated it before the time period for their restoration, which is already ongoing in bills in both the House and Senate did. So I'm really unhappy at getting this information from, I don't remember who did it, but whoever was testifying said that that was the year in question when I asked what the end of the legislative the agreement to look at it till the end of the legislative.
Well, I apologize, Representative Kahn, or Mr. Chairman. All I know is that there has been a memorandum of understanding that they would be exiting in the end of this fiscal year.
Yes.
Yes.
The person specifically said it was the end of the 04 fiscal year. But anyway, at the time I raised the question, looking at all of the agencies that came under that, is that what kind of analysis had been done about should we be allowing members of the State Fair, should we be allowing members of the Minnesota International Center and so forth into it. And I want to know what's happened with that and what the result of that analysis is,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, I guess the issue has been about whether the in conference with the Attorney General's office, we're trying to find what sort of level is the probably allowable, and whether we're challenged or not is sort of the issue. Attorney General tends to think that we need to be somewhere near the 1% level. We're slightly over that. If it is not challenged, is that acceptable? Can we do something remedial after that?
No.
But yes, we're over the 1%. These are participants of CGIP. That's the participants of CGIP members who are not directly state funded, with enough control for an easy definition that these are easily under the state control or state appropriations or members of CGIP.
You know, this agency that had two employees, I guess. You know, with the understanding that this costs the state nothing because they're paying...
That's correct. They're paying the premiums. That's right.
But, you know, it seems to me that the state fair, which gets no state appropriation, must have an awful lot more employees, and there must be in that list an awful lot more contribution to that 1% level than the humanities.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Khan, I think actually most of the increase is the two credit unions that are actually members of CGIP. Affinity Credit Union and Highway Credit Union are where most of the numbers of employees are. Most of these have historical connection, obviously, to this state control, state appropriation issue, some of which has been severed years ago. But there's been a historical link, but that's the only link we can find.
Well,
that's where hundreds of employees are.
Yeah, I guess I'm interested in what's going on with the analysis of, you know, I'm particularly concerned about the, and which may be a moot point because I gather there is legislation to both reinstate the agency and to probably do some level of appropriation for the Humanities Commission. It was only brought to me because of the clearly premature, and the bill hasn't passed, so although it did pass the Government Operations Committee, the clearly premature elimination of the Humanities Commission employees, you know, beyond the in violation of the Memorandum of Understanding. But
anything else on
Representative
that, Commissioner? Yeah, I was at that. We were at the meeting, and it was not conveyed properly that it was 05. It was my understanding it was 04 when we voted on it. So.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I.
And you weren't there.
Well,
not blaming you.
I'm gasping for you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions? Because we have to move on.
We're in the middle of the analysis, Representative.
Okay.
Any other quick questions? We have to move on to amateur sports. Thank you. We appreciate your work. Appreciate that extra work that you did on the workforce report.
Just one quick question, too, and I think it's just a yes or no. In the PEEP program,
yes.
You talked about the administrative fees. Is that also paid for by the local units of government?
Yes, it is, completely.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for coming down, Representative Mahler. You,
Mr. Chairman,
they're coming down. What is this handout all about?
Mr. Chairman, I handed this out. It was a response to my statement about trying to read Mark Shepard's handwriting. So he wrote me a memo that he had asked the computer staff to run some of the amendments he drafted through some handwriting recognition software, hoping it would produce something that would be more useful. And this is what was produced by the handwriting recognition software.
Wow.
I hope it didn't destroy our software.
What amendment was this, Mark? Is it something for GovOps, I'm assuming, that we throw over to you? Okay, very good. Mr. Erickson, good morning. If you guys could introduce yourselves and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Paul Erickson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, and I have with me a board member appointed by Governor Plenty, Chubb Stewart. To make the presentation brief and to kind of give you an executive summary rather than to read through our narration, which you've had in the past. This is the agency report, but it's from the last binding. We don't do a nice dance report, but the chairman said that there are a number of members who are new to our agency, so this will provide a really good background to the work of the agency. The second handout that I'm going to go over is the new report, which is briefer, less costly, a one-pager of the summary of the economic impact of the agency. And then I have a third document, which nets out the governor's recommendation for our budget. First off, this report is a good summary of all of the activity of the agency. The agency was created for three primary purposes. One is to use amateur sports as an economic development tool. And back in the late 80s, that was a novel and a new concept. But I think you'll see as you page through this document and to see the results, we've proven the concept successful. That if you create a program or a facility in Minnesota that's of quality, people will take their families from Iowa, from Ohio, from Norway, from Brazil, and they'll travel to Minnesota to have that great experience for their kids and their family. And if you look at the chart on the cover of this, prior to the creation of the Amateur Sports Commission, Minnesota generated less than $3 or $4 million a year from economic benefit from amateur sports. As you'll see in the second chart, we're now approaching $70 million every year of impact that comes from outside our borders into Minnesota. The second goal of the commission after economic impact was to create more opportunities for Minnesotans. And you'll see from the report that literally millions of Minnesotans participate in the programs that you've developed, from the Star of the North Games to the different facilities from northern to southern Minnesota. And the centerpiece of that activity is at the National Sports Center in Blaine, which now draws more attendees than our three professional sports boxes. In 2004, the National Sports Center in Blaine had 3,200,000 visitors. That's more than the Metrodome, Target Center, or Excel. Now, the new chart shows that we've had a progression since 1987. Now we're approaching $70 million. Every year, at least one legislator makes the point, well, are these projections, estimates, that you guys get a lot of thick documents with projections about economic impact. I want you to know when you see this chart, what's behind it are actual empirical data. And I'll tell you why our world is better to get exact numbers than other types of tourism activity. If you measured the Mall of America on visitors, they can estimate how many visitors. It's a little more challenging for them to say, where did those visitors come from? Did they come drive up from Shakopee, or did they come from Madison, Wisconsin? Well, when we have a soccer tournament like the Schwann's USA Cup, where we have almost 1,000 teams, we can tell you that 60% of the teams were from other states. So we see a registration from an under-16 girls team from Ohio, 20 players. We know from their hotel records that they brought another 20 parents. So our numbers have been tested throughout the years by the Department of Tourism and independent studies. So when you see a report from the Amateur Sports Commission, it's based on actual hard data, not looking out over in a stadium full of people and estimating how many from outside Minnesota. They are from registered participants in our events.
I'm not sure if we want to go through the whole presentation, do questions, or do we want to represent all areas at this point?
Mr. Chairman, it was just a quick one to this point.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm just wondering where this is going. I hear so much about stadiums here. If you know, we heard in through years of testimony in tax committee that it's basically Minnesotans going to the stadium no matter where it is. So we're shifting money around, and you're producing something that shows we're actually getting something from outside the state. So are you looking for a stadium now? Or,
Mr. Erickson?
Representative Muller, Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to report that we have no stadium proposals in the Amateur Sports Commission. So that's a good segue into the final handout, which is the executive summary of our budget. The governor's recommending basically a 42% cut from our $525,000 level in the last biennium to a $300,000 budget. Now, and Chuck Stewart from our board is going to comment to this in just a moment, but we really believe that we're at a very basic minimum position to maintain the investment that you have made as legislators. We believe that this $300K is a minimum position to do several things. Number one, maintain the oversight of the National Sports Center. If you look at that chart with $70 million of economic impact, 50%, half of it comes from that one facility. Secondly, it is now almost a $50 million state asset, with half the funds coming from legislative appropriations, half from city, county, and private appropriations. That's a large piece of property, a large asset to maintain. Your Amateur Sports Commission oversees that to make sure it's growing in the right direction, follows the right policies, and so on. Now, the other thing I want to make this point, and we're really proud of this, this is your only state asset that does not receive a state operating subsidy. The building we're in is subsidized. The state capitol is subsidized. Every state park is subsidized. The Minnesota Zoo was sold to you as a break-even proposition. Your annual subsidy is approaching $20 million. In the history of the National Sports Center, we have never received an operating subsidy from the state, the city, or the county. In addition, not only are we covering the heat, the lights, the operating costs, it's probably your only state asset which has never received CAFRA dollars. The facility was opened in 1990. If a big air conditioning unit breaks down or there's a hole in the parking lot, off the operating statement, we're covering that. So when you think about this, your $300,000 state investment oversees this $50 million asset, makes sure it continues to break even, makes sure it continues to handle its short-term capital replacement. Secondly, one of the other dividends you get from this $300K, a return on investment, we operate the Star of the North Games. Approximately 8,000 to 10,000 athletes every year. We move the event around the state from Moorhead to St. Cloud to Rochester to Burnsville to Roseville, and it creates great opportunities for Minnesota. It doesn't bring new money into the state, but it's a great opportunity. And then third, your $300,000 investment, make sure that you maintain some level of this $70 million annual benefit. And I do want to put you on notice that, I mean, a few short years ago, we had 11 staff and over $1 million budget. We don't bid for as many events as we used to. We don't start as many new programs as we used to. And I would predict that that $70 million could taper off because we just don't have the same number of staff producing new activity. Now, the second chart of this packet, and I think this is also noteworthy. You folks have been in a very difficult task of downsizing government, making government more lean and mean. If you look at the sheet with the two pie charts, in our second year of operation, 1988, state funding represented 75% of the activity. Today, as we've leveraged private activity, state involvement is 3% of the activity. So we're an agency that's going the right direction. And then finally, just to demonstrate, an agency which once had 11 staff, we have already made our reductions and let people go, and so there are now three staff members left at the Amateur Sports Commission. And with that, I'm going to have Chuck Stewart just make some brief remarks and perspective from the point of view of a board member. Chuck has been appointed by Governor Plenty, and prior to that, Governor Carlson and Governor Ventura. Chuck Stewart.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's a privilege to be here. You can probably tell from my gray hair I've been around for a while, and I'm very, very interested in amateur sports. I've seen what amateur sports has done for the state economically. I've seen what it's done for families. I'm a firm believer that families that play together stay together. And I was very pleased in 1991 when Governor Carlson appointed me to the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. I was reappointed by Jesse Ventura, governor at the time, and then recently Governor Plenty. And I'm the vice chair of the Sports Commission, been there 14 years, and I've enjoyed every moment of it. As Paul indicated, that at one time when I joined, we had 11 staff members and a budget of $1.1 million. And today we're down to three staff members and asking your support for $300,000. We have faced the budgetary cuts that you've asked us to address in the last several years, and have trimmed and trimmed and trimmed to the point where now, as a member of the commission, I can tell you that in my view, and in the view of my colleagues on the commission, we're down to absolute bare bones. If we're going to continue to survive, we're going to have your continued support to fund us at this level. 1991, when we saw the advantages of what was happening here at the state in terms of the tourism that was coming into the state through amateur sports, in my hometown of Rochester, we emulated the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. We worked with the staff up here, and we created a sports commission in Rochester that is now the largest sports commission in the upper Midwest. We have more employees, full-time employees, in the state commission. We have a larger budget. And we have a board of directors of 30 people representing sports medicine from Mayo Clinic, current and former coaches, representatives of the various sporting entities in Rochester, like the football, the basketball, the volleyball interests, and so forth. We are very, very active in pursuing major sporting events for the state of Minnesota because we've seen the economic advantage. We bring in national AAU championships. We bring in NCAA national championships. We have all kinds of activity going on constantly in our community. We brought in international championships. The tug of war was there last year. We've seen the economic advantage. We've seen what it does for families and kids. It provides employment as well for hundreds and hundreds of referees, and the economic impact is so significant that we like where we're at in our community, and we continue to grow because we know this is where the money is. I can tell you that from our experience on the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, that the single event that we have, the greatest soccer event in the world, where 900 to 1,000 teams come into Minnesota every year for the USA Cup, it's the second largest tourist event that we have in the state of Minnesota, second to the Mega Mall. And we're bringing in tens of millions of dollars in the Twin City areas being spent in the hotel, motel, fast food, the restaurant industries, gas stations, and so forth. You know the scene as well as I do. I can just say to you that that I've been a businessman all my life. I've owned three separate businesses in my younger days. I've been through tough times, and I've been through good times. And we have had to cut back in my businesses when things got tough and prune out those things that needed to be pruned out, but we never pruned out the hard core of what our businesses were all about that made us money, that kept us alive. And I'm here to tell you that, we're right at that edge now on the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission, where we need your continued support because we are bringing money in by the millions to the state of Minnesota. And we need the support of your committee and certainly the support of the legislature to carry out the mandate that you created in 1987. So thank you for giving us this opportunity to speak to you, and I'll turn it back to Paul.
Okay, very good. We met the time frame we were looking at. We'll open it up for questions. One thing that we in 2003 we got the financial statements for the Sports Center Foundation. Are the 04s available for our fiscal analysts to have available, Mr. Erickson, do you know? Or
Mr. Chairman, the Amateur Sports Commission Board requires that the National Sports Center Foundation do an annual audit, and will accept their audited 04 financials, I think, at the end of March, middle April. So as soon as we have those, we'll be happy to forward them to your board.
Wonderful. Okay, questions from members. Representative Kahn.
A couple of questions. Did you hand out the membership of the amateurs of the current board? No, it isn't. It's the old one.
Or is that the old one? So I see Representative Mayers is on there. Have those new appointments been made, Mr. Erickson?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, I'll get you the new members. I know that...
I'm particularly interested in the appointments by the Senate, the House, and the Governor. Do you know who those people are?
Yes, the House appointees are Representative Meslow and Representative Westerberg, and there is an open speaker appointment currently. On the Senate side, it is Senator Ann Rest, Senator Cal Larson, and Senator Jim Metzen.
Okay, I would like the and the Governor's appointment.
Do you want to?
Okay. Well, that's okay. I would like those given out, and I'd like those appointments detailed.
Okay.
And I think you know which appointments I'm interested in to see if they meet the state law.
Okay.
And I have to apologize for not. We used to have the son of a cousin from Alaska come to the soccer cup which was very nice because he came several years in a row. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid it was negative economic development because not only did he stay with us, but it also changed our restaurant behavior down to McDonald's and the old Spaghetti House and things like that. So it probably cost the state alcohol and food sales tax and so forth. But I'm interested. I know that there's a track and field trick. Oh, I'm interested. I know that the state used to put some money into that Olympic training center, and now you get it's totally supported by the Olympic Committee. We used to do.
Right.
Oh, I remember we did a state appropriation once for that. To support women's winter sports.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, we received, I think 6 years ago, $1 million grant from the U.S. Olympic Committee for three or four sports, of which girls and women's hockey was one of the featured activities. We raised some private dollars. We did receive some legislative grants to match that in order to get the Olympic grant. That program, the Olympic Committee discontinued their funding, and now the program is surviving on private funds by an independent group. And so we supported the program for all of those years until about 3 months ago, and then because it didn't, like, one thing, there's a rule of thumb, and I know sometimes people are frustrated with the higher fees that we charge the National Sports Center, but there's 80 different sport programs. If the program doesn't pay for itself, it's eliminated because there is no subsidy for our facility. That program we actually saw, Representative Kahn, was headed toward subsidy. And so we recommended to the group that would be better off on their own, and so a group of hockey enthusiasts are maintaining that as private citizens.
Okay, then the next question is, I know that there's also track and field training for Olympics and so forth. I think it's private, but does that get any, do you have any connection with that? It's mainly from U.S. track and field.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pound and Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's the same program, but in addition to hosting the state high school track and field meet and the TRU team, we have a track and field club of mostly high school age girls and boys that we provide a very favorable rate, but they pay a fee and they participate several times a week, you know, as a preseason event. I don't think it has any official Olympic sanction, though, so I don't think we're affiliated with that program.
Now, this is the program that really dealt with the Olympic class athletes, like Carrie Tellison. And so forth. Okay.
Representative Solberg?
Mr. Chairman, your development in Blaine, by the way, this was a big boondoggle, remember, from Rudy Perpich's idea of amateur sports, and it wasn't going to apply, and it was going to have all kinds of problems. And
I was in sixth grade, Representative Solberg. I was part of the.
I understand that, but this is some of his economic development that it was just absolutely not going to be type of thing we needed in Minnesota.
The Mall of America, right?
Yeah, like the Mall of America, too. The other question is, but my question is, in Blaine, with the huge development out there, much of it can be related to the Amateur Sports Commission facility up there. I mean, there's other things as well, land availability and quality of life and roads and everything else that goes with economic development. But my question is, does the city of Blaine impose a 3% motel hotel tax?
Ms. Harrison?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Solberg, the city of Blaine has imposed that tax and is a member of the North Metro Minneapolis Convention Visitors Bureau. There are, one hotel in Blaine, but there are proposals to build three more that were just in a local paper. But yes, they do pay that tax.
And Mr. Chairman, we'll do the, besides the general or promotion of the event, do they help promote any of your events locally that have a direct effect for the city of Blaine and their industry?
Representative Sullivan, Mr. Sure. Chairman, I'm pleased to report that the Minneapolis Metro North Chamber of Commerce has been a sponsor of the National Sports Center for probably, 10, 12 years. And I don't know the exact level of financial support, but there's a formula that they receive based on the rooms that they produce. And the National Sports Center is the largest producer of hotel rooms in the North Metro by and lead by a country mile. And I believe it's several hundred thousand dollars a year flow from the Convention Visitors Bureau to support the facility. So they're showing and demonstrating that they're helping making that facility work.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Erickson, I just had a question on the Commission Foundation membership. How is that determined? I know kind of how the Sports Commission itself is appointed with House Senate Governor. I didn't see any rural members on the Amateur Sports Foundation Board. It's entirely basically all Minneapolis, St. Paul, and suburban people.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, you know, in the last 4 months, the Amateur Sports Commission eliminated the Amateur Sports Commission Foundation to the budget cuts. They had a, you know, a small reserve, and so now that has been absorbed by the National Sports Center Foundation because of lack of staff support to staff the meetings and just to consolidate to make it more efficient. So that has now been amalgamated into the National Sports Center Foundation. So, you know, you make a good point. There's also a board of volunteers that serve on the National Sports Center Foundation board, and they're appointed by the Amateur Sports Commission, and they serve, they have many, you know, they're primarily business people to help with the business side of it. But we would be open to greater Minnesota representation. The thing that's going to be a little frustrating, we can't offer, you know, mileage or per right. diem because it's a pure volunteer assignment.
Okay, we have to get to Representative Rukavina. Okay. I've seen no more hands up. Okay, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rukavina, if you'd come down, the chair will move. Actually, you would have the House File 303 be suspended and that Senate File 418 be substituted for House File 303. And we'll move the Senate File, be recommended to pass by the committee. And I don't think this needs to go to Ways and Means, Representative Solberg, does it? It just go to the register? Okay, Representative Rukavina, welcome. We're sorry that the time frame got compressed. And if you'd introduce your guest and give us a little overview of the bill, please.
Mr. Chair and members, with me, Dana Fry, who's the county administrator for St. Louis County. And the reason I'm here is because we had a land exchange between counties and the state back in a 1998 statute that I helped pass and actually had Willard's, Munger's approval on it. And when that exchange took place, we established these what we call environmental trust funds in each of the counties that where the cabins got sold, and that's what happened. They were transferred to private individuals. My understanding is that current law prohibits counties from investing in things that the State Board of Investment does, and I see Mr. Vickers here, and what this allows is the county board to choose if they want to have this fund invested in the State Board of Investment. The yield has been very nominal, at least in St. Louis County, on their investments because of the restrictions in law, and I asked Mr. Shepard to draft this bill for me before this year started, and so I'd appreciate your support. I don't think there's any controversy. The county's, it's permissive language, and talking to Mr. Bicker, he's more than happy to grab their money and invest it for him. So.
Mr. Bicker, are you okay with this bill? Okay, I see you nodding. And I assume, Mr. Fry, that you've had some discussions with the State Board of Investment already on this bill and have had preliminary discussions?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. Questions from members? The chair will renew his motion that Senate File 418 be recommended to pass, place in the general register. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those say nay. Bill passes, and we'll head off to the floor. And members, we will see you tomorrow morning. Meeting's adjourned.